Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We have a very special guest in store for you today. He is America's number one integrative cardiologist. In case you can't guess who that is, I'll give it away. He's Dr. Stephen Sinatra. And he's been a frequent guest on my radio program on WOR, Health Talk, and now we're bringing him for the first time to Intelligent Medicine. Because he's got a lot to talk about. He's also in the process of conducting a series of informative webinars, which we're going to tell you about. But he's highly credentialed. He is a board-certified cardiologist, which is unusual in the field of complementary and alternative medicine, because that's a very advanced credential. He's also a specialist in nutrition, because he's a fellow of the American College of Nutrition. He's spoken at that conference quite frequently. He's much in demand as a speaker across the country, and he's written a variety of great books. Welcome to the program, Stephen. It's nice having you back here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. What are some of the books that you've written, by the way?
Well, the last one, Ron, was A Great Cholesterol Myth. That's been out for almost a year. And then we have the Great Cholesterol Myth cookbook coming out in November. And the one before The Great Cholesterol Myth was Grounding, My Greatest Health Discovery Ever.
Okay, and we can get into that a little bit. But I think the book that you're most remembered for, a real breakthrough book, was Reverse Heart Disease Now.
And Metabolic book, Cardiology. Those two.
And Metabolic Cardiology. And you know, I have to say, you know, you've really made some major contributions to the field. I think that it's fair to say that you single-handedly introduced America to coenzyme Q10. And the subsequent coenzyme Q10 craze is in large part attributable to you, you know, because we began to be aware of the heart benefits of coenzyme Q10 and, you know, made it possible. So kudos to you.
Ron, it's amazing. I'm in my 31st year of using coenzyme Q10. I mean, I started using it in my early 30s, you know, when I got my boards in cardiology. And I had it on formulary at my hospital in 1992. And there's been three clinical studies, one that came out in 2008 in the American College of Cardiology, which demonstrated that higher blood levels of coenzyme Q10 in the body actually made you live longer with congestive heart failure. That was from the New Zealand researchers. And then in 2013, there was two articles that came out. One was the World Congress in Cardiology that showed a double-blind study demonstrating that, again, coenzyme Q10, the counterparts who were taking placebo lived half as long as the people getting coenzyme Q10 at the World Congress in Cardiology. Then another article came out in 2013 in Sweden where elderly folks from 78 to like 88 taking selenium and coenzyme Q10, they had much better quality of life issues and less cardiovascular events. So it's amazing that the literature on coenzyme Q10 is so strong right now.
You know, I have to laugh because I recently, you know, I peruse all the medical literature and I try to stay on top of it for my patients and for my podcasts and my radio show. And I came across an article that it kind of surprised me. It said, brand new drug discovered for congestive heart failure. And I thought, wow, you know, I didn't know that there was a brand new drug discovered. And it was an article about coenzyme Q10. And it was said, this is the first new, and they use the term drug for congestive heart failure that's been developed in the last 20 years. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting.
Wow. Where did you read that?
It was in Science Daily. Science Daily is an interesting compendium of articles about medical and health breakthroughs, and they called it a drug. And in fact, it is drug-like in its effects. But, you know, that's the kind of thing, you know, you probably want to get an image capture of that for one of your slide presentations.
Oh, definitely. I would love to get it.
At a medical conference. I'll send you the reference.
Yeah, send me the link. You have my email, right?
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks so much, Ron. That's good. You'll empower me again.
I always, always want to make you look good. I mean, not that you need any help. So these days, you know, you're doing a lot of communicating, and there's a brand new effort to get the word out via webinars. Tell us about what that series is about.
Yeah, actually, I'm doing a webinar on September 19th at 2 p.m.
That's coming right up. Okay.
Yes, coming right up. And it's based on the great cholesterol myth. I actually will be doing part of it live. Part of it was taped. And I'll be handling questions. But in the seminar, I'm really going to dispel the great cholesterol myth, talk about the real causes of heart disease, and really talk about my six pillars of healing, which you and I have talked about in the past. And one of them is emotional support, using mind-body interventions, earthing, you know, what can earthing do for you? But the majority of the show, which I'll be answering live questions, is really going to be on, you know, do I have to take statin drugs, you know, are saturated fats okay? Talk about diet and the cholesterol hypothesis. Talk about the myth, you know, and why statin drugs are not really good for a lot of people. I mean, I will tell you this on your program now that a middle-aged male with documented coronary disease, you know, a statin is a good idea, especially if you chase it down with a couple hundred milligrams of CoQ10. Mm-hmm. But I believe that statins are only helping middle-aged males, not women, not children, although very rarely I'll use a statin in a woman or a child. And by a child, I mean maybe somebody 18 years old with familial hypercholesterolemia.
And that would be someone with a cholesterol 500. Like 500 or something like that.
Yeah, correct.
Right.
But like, you know, for the most part, statins really work in middle-aged men. And I don't do it for cholesterol lowering. Remember, Ron, statins have a wide variety of effects. We call them pleiotropic effects. But they're potent anti-inflammatories. They're potent antioxidants. They reduce adhesion molecules by making the blood thinner. And remember, in men with low HDLs, their blood becomes more like red ketchup because HDL actually thins the blood. And statins do work well in males in that population with low HDL.
So you're thinking of the statins more as like a sort of a super aspirin as opposed to a cholesterol lowering agent.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, they happen to lower cholesterol, but Ron, I gotta tell you straight off, I think cholesterol is the wrong marker in heart disease. I mean, look, it's found at the scene of the crime, but it's not the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
And all the airtime it's given on TV, I mean, we've created this fear in America called hypercholesterolemia, and nothing is farther from the truth. I mean, we need cholesterol. It's vital for our health, longevity, and aliveness. So but why kill it?
You're certainly sounding a theme that many of my guests recently have enunciated, which is that cholesterol is not the culprit. It may be an innocent bystander, or it may even be a helpful agent. And yet we're chasing our tails in an effort to lower it. But how do you, I mean, a question that I'm just dying to ask you is, how do you account for the continued popularity and robustness of the vegan diet? I mean, we have a poster boy for the vegan diet, although he admits to having a little bit of this and a little bit of that. You know, he's not that disciplined. Former President Bill Clinton, who's on speed dial to Dr. Caswell Esselstyn and Dean Ornish and all the apostles of vegan and ultra-low-fat and low-cholesterol vegetarian diets, there's still a lot of pushback from people who think that cholesterol is the culprit.
Correct. Well, first of all, Caldwell Illestine's book is a very good book. You know, he is a staunch vegetarian. And if you look at, if you read his book, it's the complete opposite of mine. But if you do follow his book, you will lower heart disease. And why is that so if it's the complete opposite of what I recommend?
Yeah,
that's
a paradox. I mean, how do you reconcile that?
But if you look at what Caldwell is talking about, and by the way, he's a great American. I have a lot of respect for him. I think he chose the wrong marker in cholesterol. But his diet, if you follow his diet closely, he throws out all omega-6 oils, which are truly inflammatory.
Okay.
So he's throwing out omega-6 oils.
Saying no corn oil, no safflower oil, none of
no
these so-called healthy oils.
He vilifies avocado and even coconut because coconut's saturated fat, and avocado is monounsaturated fat. I think he's very wrong. But he's going to get results because, look, when you throw out the omega-6 oils, you're taking away a huge inflammatory component. So he's doing his clientele a lot of good. The other thing he's doing, which I totally embrace and I totally endorse, is that if you eat his way, you're going to get about 50 to 60 grams of fiber a day in his diet.
Okay.
Now, his diet's tough to to cook or prepare, it requires a lot of time. But if you do have time on your hands, or if you have a chef that can do it for you, it's a healthy way of eating. Now, what's the downside of that diet? And this is where I have a pushback with, you know, the vegetarian gurus. If you do a straight vegan diet, you are going to omit omega-6s. You are going to take in a lot of fiber, which are good things. But the bad things are you are not going to get enough coenzyme Q10 in the diet. You're going to get very low levels of carnitine. You're not going to get enough alpha-lipoic acid, and certainly not enough B12. So people will have problems on that diet. Now, from the cardiovascular point of view, over the short and probably intermediate terms, and maybe even, you know, 20 years or so, I don't think you're going to have any, you're not going to be compromised. But I have seen people on vegan diets long-term, when I've tested their vitamin CoQ10 levels and their carnitine levels, mm-hmm. They were very, very low. Now, I've had two patients in my practice. They were both women. They both had congestive cardiomyopathy, both Asian, both staunch vegans, and they both had breast cancer.
Oh.
Now, that's kind of interesting. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Cardiomyopathy and breast cancer in the same patient. And when I tested their Q10 and carnitine levels, again, they were in the basement. So I brought that issue up to a panel at the American College of Nutrition, and they totally disregarded it, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of these, I guess, strict vegetarians really are quite rigid. And the same is true of the people who follow the Paleolithic diet. There's
right.
a lot of rigidity on both sides of the fence.
I mean, you can argue, you know, various things, but it's hard to argue diet. It's hard to argue politics. It's hard to argue religion. You know, I think that there's a religious zeal that's associated with different stances about diet, and, you know, vegetarians and carnivores are hard to reconcile.
No, I agree. And I mentioned to even Colin Campbell and the people on the committee, well, it's all about balance. I said, I like the 80-20 rule, you know, 80% plant-based, 20%, you know, organic game like bison, wild salmon, you know, sardines, you know, migratory, you know, other small fish like scrotta, cod, you know, even poultry and range-fed beef. I said, you know, an 80-20 rule is great to go. Why vilify coconut? Why vilify avocado? And I got an enormous pushback. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a zeal to eliminate fat, and when we recognize that fat, A, is a fuel, and B, is a source of beneficial nutrition, is a very important component of the human diet, I mean, I just don't see it.
You're absolutely right, Ron. See, the Achilles heel for a PhD or an MD or a researcher or a clinician is rigidity. And, you know, it's all about balance. I really believe balance is the key to health. So, you know, when you're all one way or all this way, you are really losing out. So,
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
when it comes to diet therapies, I mean, I'm a big believer in a Pan-Asian Mediterranean diet. I like eating from the Pacific Rim as well as the Mediterranean basin. And look, the fat content of those diets is 25 to 30%, and they are the longest, well, they have the best longevities in the world. And the recent data that came out of Spain on the Mediterranean diet was absolutely awesome, you know, and that was 30% fat. So I got to tell you, from where I sit as a clinical cardiologist, the way we vilified fats in the past is absolutely horrendous.
Right, that reminds me, I've got to go to the store and get some olive oil because I'm almost out.
Yeah, you know, one thing about olive oil, have you been privy to the stuff coming out of Spain and Italy, that some of it's cut with canola oil, and you're not getting pure olive oil?
Well, you know, here's a problem, too, in some of the research. They've actually done some research on fish oil, finding that fish oil is not heart healthy, but then the placebo was olive oil capsules. So how's that going to work when olive oil is heart healthy? I just love when they do
HDL,
stuff like that. I know.
It can also make, you know, a small BB shot LDL a little more fluffier.
Right. So it's, you know, they actually have, they tried to debunk fish oil by using olive oil as a placebo. That doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. So I hope they didn't spend too many millions of our taxpayer dollars doing that study.
Oh, my God. It's amazing what researchers will do.
Yeah. So going back to, you know, some of your earlier work, you know, you talk about some of the key heart healthy nutrients. I think it was something like, I don't know how you formulated it. It was like the fearsome foursome or the fabulous five.
Yeah, the awesome foursome.
The awesome foursome. Very good. Okay. Yeah, I grew up in Los Angeles, and that was the front line of the Los Angeles Rams for a while. Remember Rosie Greer?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that was the fearsome foursome. And yours was the awesome foursome. So tell us about the awesome foursome.
Yeah, I mean, the awesome foursome really came out of my discovery of metabolic cardiology. I first brought it to the literature's attention in 2004 in a letter to some Israeli researchers who showed that coenzyme Q10 in patients waiting for heart transplant actually increased their quality of life. And that was in clinical cardiology almost 10 years ago, actually 10 years ago, 2004. And I coined the term metabolic cardiology, and then I decided to write the book Metabolic Cardiology in 2005 when I discovered the use of ribose. Because I used coenzyme Q10 for more than 3 decades, I've been using the carnitines for the last, 15 years, and I've been treating people with magnesium ever since I became a doctor in 1972. But when I added ribose to the mix about 8 years ago, I had this incredible awareness and aha that the combination of those 4 nutrients were able to embellish the body's production of ATP.
Wait, that's 3. That's 3, heart. Not 4. There's a fourth.
Yeah, magnesium, ribose, the carnitines, and coenzyme Q10.
I don't think you said carnitine. Maybe I missed it, but okay.
Yeah, carnitine. 20 years I've been using the carnitines.
Okay.
And basically, when you bring those 4 nutrients to the table, you're increasing energy substrates for the heart. And with anybody with heart disease, even really something as benign as mitral valve prolapse, or even these people with mild hypertension who have a little bit of left ventricular enlargement, they're still losing ATP. And anybody with mitral regurgitation, they could be losing ATP. Certainly anybody with heart disease, they're losing it out of their heart cells as well. And when I say losing ATP, think of the analogy, Ron, of having a hole in your pocket and you're putting in change. And you're losing all your change. It's going down your leg. Well, the same thing happens with anybody with heart disease, especially, people with heart failure. There's energy deprivation. And the body can't make back the ATP fast enough. And for our listeners, ATP is our prana energy, our chi energy, our life vital force. And when we lose that energy, the body's natural wisdom is struggling to make it back. But if you give D-ribose, which is really the center of the ATP molecule, it's a five-sided sugar, and when you give carnitine and CoQ10, you increase the production and turnover, and magnesium sort of is like the glue that holds the process together, you're supporting the body and making ATP. It's like fertilizing your lawn, and your lawn blooms. Now you're giving your heart the energy it needs, and that's why I've been able to really, really not only reverse a lot of heart disease and my patients over the years, but they've lived many, many years longer. And I think it has to do with stem cells. In other words, I think the metabolic cardiology helps to invigorate the stem cells, which really is the body's natural wisdom in healing itself.
Were you surprised a few months back when an article came out suggesting that the self-same carnitine that you say is so beneficial for the heart is actually something that causes atherosclerosis? What's your take on that?
Oh, that study, oh my God, that was one of the worst studies.
I have to say, I lambasted that study in one of my blogs, but I wanted to get your take on it.
I mean, how could those researchers, how could that go through peer review? I'm a peer reviewed doctor. I mean, I review articles that other doctors submit to journals, but let's face it. If that article got published in Nature, I mean, why wasn't that article, if it was so blockbusting research, if it was so good, why didn't that go to the American Journal of Cardiology or Circulation or JAMA or Archives of Internal Medicine or Annals of Internal Medicine? It ended up in an obscure journal. And if you look at what they did, I mean, I think those researchers had an agenda. I really do. And I can't believe they vilified carnitine the way they did, especially since the Mayo Clinic came out only a week or two later showing that an analysis of 13 previous studies showed that how carnitine reduced heart failure by like 40%, arrhythmias by 65%, and angina by 50%, and how given carnitines, you know, an acute heart attack, people live longer. I mean, I can't believe they came out with this research. And if you look at it, they used a mouse model, and they gave them carnitine. Now, mice are vegetarians.
Right.
Now they're giving them carnitine.
That's like giving a rabbit steak.
To it.
It's like a rabbit steak and seeing if they get a heart attack, you know.
Yeah, they used ApoB knockout mice. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was amazing what they did. I mean, I can't believe people would do research and try to twist and contort, nature like that. I mean,
but I think there was an interesting point of that article, and you know, it was missed in the subsequent furor over whether carnitine is healthy or not good for you, and that is that there are certain intestinal bacteria which may act on certain foods, healthy foods like lecithin, which is derived from soy and other foods, and carnitine, which is derived from meat, and that the state of your intestinal tract may determine your risk of cardiovascular disease. And I even saw an interesting editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine suggesting that maybe we should give people antibiotics for cardiovascular disease. Well, I say give them probiotics,
right.
You know, give us beneficial bacteria so we don't transform healthy substances into dangerous artery damaging chemicals.
You know, you're right about that. You know, the research has had patents on those on some antibiotics for TMAO, and they also had patents
on the test.
So
on the blood
test. I think there were other agendas. But look, you know, Ron, I mean, they vilified meat. I mean, codfish has much higher levels of carnitine.
Yes.
Or TMAO than
It's full of choline. You know, choline being
it's choline.
Yes.
Fish.
Choline.
And we don't think fish is healthy for the heart. But
right.
Fish contains much higher quantities.
Yeah.
They didn't vilify fish.
Exactly. Because the researcher said, well, this may be the reason that meat is bad for the heart. Well, the studies don't show that actually meat is associated with cardiovascular disease. We can go over some of those studies, but I'm sure you've looked at some of the epidemiology. But sure know
actually,
that.
We wrote about a lot of those in the Great Cholesterol Myth. But I don't want to bring up one thing.
Yep.
What is the one major meat in the Mediterranean diet? Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I don't know.
Take a guess.
I'm thinking maybe poultry. I'm going to take a wild guess. Poultry, chicken.
They eat chicken, but they eat a lot of lamb.
Oh, okay.
Lamb, wow. If you go to Greece, you know, or if you go to a Greek restaurant.
Souvlaki, yeah.
Yeah, all that stuff, you know. Spain has a lot of lamb.
Right.
I mean, you know, certainly the Mediterranean basin, the basin in North Africa, in the Middle East, they eat a lot of lamb, you know. I got to tell you, the highest quantities of carnitine are found in lamb.
Yeah, it's a very red meat, yeah.
Yeah, much more than beef. I mean, my God, I mean, you get way more carnitine in lamb, and lamb is a staple of the Mediterranean diet, and the Mediterranean diet blows away all the other diets in reversing or preventing heart disease.
Interesting.
So,
yeah.
I'll tell you, I got so many questions about this study that it really defied my imagination.
Okay, to switch gears a little bit, you know, we talk about coenzyme Q10, and you know, you're aware because, you know, you sort of struggled with this, you know, originally you're very excited about coenzyme Q10, and then studies came out which show that, coenzyme Q10 wasn't beneficial, but then they were using levels of CoQ10 that didn't make sense, like 50 milligrams a day or at most 100 milligrams a day. How much CoQ10 does it take to help the heart?
Yeah, it depends on the bioavailability. Two of the studies that you're mentioning, one was done in Australia and the other was done in this country at the University of Maryland. And both of these studies were well designed, but what they did is they used poor quality CoQ10s that weren't bioavailable, so they weren't being absorbed in the body. And when they drew the blood levels in the Maryland study, which really kiboshed CoQ10, 50% of the participants taking CoQ10 didn't even absorb any. Because the standard deviation was like 1+1, and the blood level was only, it went up to 2. So half of them didn't even have a bump in their blood level. So when it comes to CoQ10, bioavailability is key.
And how do you assure that? I mean, there's all these claims.
Well, there's a poor man's test you can do.
Yeah.
First of all, if you're taking ubiquinol, ubiquinol is made by Japan, and it's a good bioavailable form of CoQ10. It's much more expensive. But I've been using ubiquinones for years, and this is a test you can do. You can take a CoQ10 that's in a soft gel or a powder or a liquid, and put it in very, very warm water, like the temperature of your blood, like 100 degrees, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the pill or if the powder or if the soft gel dissolves after about 30 or 40 seconds and it becomes homogeneous in the water, well, then you know that CoQ10 is going to be absorbed in your body.
Okay.
If it stays on top of the water, if it doesn't dissolve in the water, that means that it is poorly bioavailable and it's not going to be absorbed into the bloodstream.
Mm.
So that's sort of a test that I would recommend my subscribers. And when I was first starting using CoQ10, I used to always talk about bioavailability.
Right. This is an opportunity to tell people that they can subscribe to your excellent newsletter. So tell them how do they do that.
Well, actually, it's free now. It's online. It's on drsinatra.com.
Great. Okay.
Just click on there and get a free e-letter, you know, my weekly blogs and, you know, all my daily tweets, all that stuff. And then the other website that's purely informational, which I got a ton of information out there, is heartmdinstitute.com.
HeartMDInstitute.com. Okay, great. And for the webinar, is there a sign-up or is there a fee?
Well, actually, they can go to HeartMDInstitute.com or they can go to DrSinatra.com.
Okay. And, is there a fee? Is it a...
Oh, no, it's all free. I think they just opt in, clicked in. They can get a space. I think there's still some openings. I know there's about 4,000 people that have already signed up, and I think they have room for a few hundred more.
That's going to be a hell of a conference call.
It's going to be. It really is. we put a lot of work into it.
That's
and,
great.
It's very good, and I anticipate, you know, being live for some of it with some live questions. It's going to be a lot of fun.
So, yeah, back to coenzyme Q10. What about dosing? I mean, some people, you know, say a person has bad congestive heart failure. You know, they're, you know, New York category one or two, or, you know, they're barely making it across the room. How much do they need to take to improve their shortness of breath and their ward off a heart transplant?
Yeah, well, you know, these class four patients you're talking about,
class four
heart failure.
Right.
Some of these patients I've used 400, 500, 600 milligrams of CoQ10. I mean, the sicker the patient, the more CoQ10, because you need to get the blood level up about 7 times normal.
Mm-hmm. And you're a big believer in testing. You actually.
Oh yeah. I test blood levels just like we do when we do conventional medicine, when we test blood levels.
The joxin,
Coumadin, yep. All that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But healthy people, Ron, you know, 50 to 100 milligrams of CoQ10 is all what a healthy person needs. Now, if you're on a statin, I recommend 200 milligrams.
Okay.
You know, high blood pressure, you know, 200 to 300 milligrams, mitral valve prolapse, 100 milligrams, athletes, 100 to 200 milligrams. You know, so, you know, in metabolic cardiology, at the back of it, I talk about what dosing I give to, you know, whether it's metabolic syndrome, fibromyalgia, you know, waiting for a heart transplant, mild congestive heart failure. There's different dosing, but generally, the sicker the patient, the higher the doses of carnitine, CoQ10, and ribose.
Did you hear about the latest cholesterol drug? It's a drug it's a revolutionary new drug. It's a drug that's designed to not lower overall cholesterol, but it's designed to raise HDL. Well, unfortunately, it crashed and burned. So how is it? I mean, we believe in these theories that, you know, HDL is very protective, and then they come up with these multi-billion-dollar blockbuster drugs that crash and burn before they're even off the launch pad.
Right, because it's not natural. First of all, you can't mess with HDL. HDL does so much for the body, not only for cardiovascular disease, but remember, HDL is one of the most important constituents of the immune system. So, you know, there are cardiologists, myself included, that believe in immunology and the heart. I mean, Jim Roberts, you should probably get him on your radio station.
He's great.
Out in Toledo, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
He's the best cardiologist that I know of that talks about, you know, immunology and the heart. And it is true that your HDL is really a great support for the immune system. But when you mess with HDL and you can mess around with the immune system, you can actually cause harm. And remember, what's the fourth leading cause of death in America today? It's properly prescribed pharmaceutical drugs.
Yep.
So we got to be careful of pharmaceutical drugs, and we really need safer alternatives.
Coming back to ribose, ribose is a nutrient that some people know about it, but what type of dosing are we talking about with ribose, and who should be considering it?
Okay, like, you know, I went to a Pilates class this morning, and I had 5 grams in my tea before I went to the class.
Okay.
You know, I've
used it before some workouts, too.
Yeah, either before or after the workout. But, you know, for healthy people, just 1 teaspoon a day before a workout. For people, you know, with, again, a severely compromised heart, I would do at least 1 teaspoon 3 times a day, whether it's angina, diabetic heart, whether they have heart failure. Hypertension, I use 1 teaspoon 2 times a day. So, again, the sicker the person, the more the ribose.
And the Jacob Teitelbaum, the fibromyalgia guru, recommends it for his patients with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, that same dose, 1 teaspoon 3 times daily.
Yeah, because, you know, the heart is no different than skeletal muscle. And remember, the problem with fibromyalgia and cardiomyopathy is that in order to activate what we call the calcium pumps in both skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle, it requires higher energy. The body needs higher energy in the cells. And what ribose will do, it will boost the ATP in a cell. So since it requires higher energy to relax a muscle as opposed to stimulating a muscle, that's why it works so well in fibromyalgia and congestive heart failure.
Interesting. Okay, so to segue to, shall we say, a little bit more controversial area of your interests. I mean, you're an eclectic guy, kind of a Renaissance man, and you've expanded your repertoire into energy medicine. So tell us a little bit about what you've been researching on that front.
Oh, yeah, that's one of the lectures I love to give where, you know, the oldest forms of energy medicine was really putting hands-on people in the Bible, where positive intentions, positive healing, prayer, and meditation help to heal people. And then, you know, the research that Dolores Kruger did out of Cornell, you know, demonstrating that, you know, Reiki therapy could increase red blood cell mass and get the bone marrow to put out, you know, more red blood cells. And then there's electrodermal testing, there's Voles testing, there's all sorts of ways where you can use computers and biomeridians and acupuncture points to determine the different vibration of anything from bacteria to microbes to viruses to low energy like cancer. So energy medicine is pretty cool. I mean, I really like it. I think it's going to be the most modern form of medicine where computers are going to assist us in looking out the different vibrational frequencies that people have in their bodies. And if you match the frequency to the offending, let's say, microbe, like take something like the bird flu, for example. The bird flu is a very, very highly vicious a virus that can literally kill you. But, you know, there's no drugs that'll treat it, but it's very, very sensitive to frequencies. Hmm. So like a Rife machine that can put out frequencies can, you know, bust apart the virus that bird flu is associated with, and it can neutralize it immediately. So that's what energy medicine is all about. It's using different modalities of energy in healing the body. And by the way, metabolic cardiology is an early form of energy medicine. So for me as a metabolic cardiologist, because remember, I want to increase the vibration of cells. And it's the same thing with earthing and grounding. When you earth a ground, you're increasing the vibration of your cells. And whenever you do that, you're bringing more health to the table.
Well, tell us a little bit about earthing and grounding. Probably that's not big on the topics that are being aired at the current conference, the American College of Cardiology.
No, but you know something? When I discovered that walking barefoot or, in the, well, we use people in the laboratory, but it's the same thing, or sleeping grounded, when I realized that it thinned the blood and it increased what we call zeta potential or you know, it had an impact on blood viscosity. You know, Ron, when you look at the old Framingham data, you know, the higher your blood pressure, the higher your uric acid, the higher your blood sugar, the higher your blood lipids, you know, the higher the inflammation in the blood, you know, the thicker your blood. And whether you smoked, you know, the blood got really thick, you know, when you smoked. And it was a combination of these risk factors that created heart disease. But it was really the thickness of the blood that did it, you know, and that's what all these risk factors had in common, whether it was high uric acid or sugar or cigarette smoking or high blood pressure. You know, the blood was thick. And when I realized that grounding or walking barefoot thinned the blood, that was the greatest discovery I have ever made in my entire lifetime as a doctor. And I submitted my research to the American Journal of Cardiology, Circulation, International Journal of Cardiology, Blood. They all turned it down. They thought it was, you know, voodoo medicine. But I got to tell you, I mean, for me, it's the greatest healing modality I've ever seen in anybody with cardiovascular disease, because when people get sick, whether it's a stroke or a heart attack, it's thick blood, which is a culprit. And by the way, that's how statins work. Statins are blood thinners, and that's why people do better, especially middle-aged men with coronary disease on statins. So it's a complex concept, but blood viscosity, or if our red blood cells are like red ketchup, that's a very, very serious risk factor. We need our blood to be more like red wine.
So when practically speaking, you mentioned grounding, and you said one of the ways to get grounded, I mean, you're wearing rubber soles. In effect, you're not making contact with the ground. You live in Connecticut.
You're disconnected from the earth.
You live in Connecticut. So, you know, what do you do, come January or February, and it's icy. Maybe there's just been a sleet storm. Do you recommend that people walk around barefoot on the ice?
No. But, I live in Florida in wintertime, so for me it's easy.
Oh, okay.
But basically, look, suppose you live in Maine or in the Northeast. Well, if your basement floor is concrete, that'll be grounded. If you have a chimney in your house with a fireplace and you put your hands on it, you'll ground. Mm-hmm. You can put it on your stainless steel plumbing. Or you can, if your house is properly grounded, and most houses after 1968 are properly grounded, you can put plug-in pads where you use the ground of your house, or you can sleep grounded with a sheet. And, that's what I recommend my constituents do, is sleep grounded.
Okay, so that's stuff that you can find at drsinatra.com. That's all the information.
Well, grounded.com is good. Grounded.com is a good website for that.
And you have a concern also about the effects of EMFs as well.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to be lecturing in New York City on November 15th at the Open Center.
Oh, I got to catch that. Yeah. Oh, great. Actually, I'm going to be promoting that event. So, hey,
Camilla Rees, I think, is spearheading it.
I know. I'm in touch with Camilla. And, I tell you what, maybe we'll bring you back for a reprise before that event in a timely fashion to get people interested. But we have some time.
Yeah, I think Camilla's going to get a bigger area to hold more people,
Okay, great. So that'll be in November. Maybe we'll have a reprise with you talking about EMF. So let's save our thunder for then.
Sure.
Great. Okay. So anything else you want to touch upon?
No, I think I think we've touched upon anything, but I will say this, Ron. I mean, you and I have been in this business for decades now, right? I'm a little older than you, but I've been in it for 40 plus years.
We're roughly contemporaries.
Are we really?
Yeah, Brent.
When did you graduate med school?
Well, I graduated. Well, I just hit the big 6-0, so I guess that's situation.
I'm 66.
Well, there you go.
6 years old. Anyway,
You look so young and healthy.
Oh, jeez, that's Q10. But basically, I'll tell you, Ron. Look. You know this, and I know this, and I want your listeners to get this, because you empower your people all the time, and you're keeping them healthy. So I want to just say this. Look, folks, the body has this incredible innate intelligence to heal itself. We learn this through stem cell technologies. But here's the deal with our bodies. Our bone marrow, our mesenchymal stem cells, are literally replacing our cells in our body several times in a lifetime. Our GI tract is replaced almost once a year. Our organs are replaced. In fact, 42% of the heart is replaced with our stem cells over a lifetime. So our body has this intrinsic ability to repair our dead cells, and not only our skin and our intestines and our organs and even our heart and brain, our stem cells can rescue our body. We need to give our body the support it needs. We got to be a positive thinker. We have to be positive. Just always think positively. Do not think negative thoughts. That's a killer, for our natural body's intelligence to take over. We need to eat good, healthy food and water. Take targeted nutritional supports. Do some mind-body interactions. Bring grounding to the table. Get rid of EMF and be aware of the toxicity of cordless phones and cellular phones and routers and Wi-Fi. And when you do that, you give your body the raw material it needs to get better. We doctors, unfortunately, prescribe too many pharmaceutical drugs, which impairs the process of the natural innate intelligence of the body to take over. Because when we treat symptoms, we are literally inhibiting enzymatic reactions by covering up symptoms with drugs, and we need to get back to basics. So I just want to tell you that. I want to tell your listeners that, because that is really vital in healing. Positive attention, giving the body what it needs, especially what we talked about today.
Well, that's a great statement and a great way to wrap up. But I have one additional question to ask you, and I forgot to do it earlier. And that is, since we last talked, they released a study on chelation therapy. It was called the TACT study. We've talked about it here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Yep. What's your take on it?
Well, it looks like the study is showing benefit, which did show benefit.
Indeed.
And, I mean, that's what I heard. And again, I mean, I think, you know, whether you do oral chelation with vitamin K2 and, you know, pomegranate and ginger and, you know, all the things that, you know, we recommend for plaque stabilization, plaque reversal, I think it's good. If you did the IV chelation, you know, and you're taking out substances of the body, heavy metals that can cause harm, remember, these heavy metals, whether it's lead or mercury, they oxidize LDL. And oxidized LDL becomes angry, and it does create inflammation. LDL that's not oxidized, who cares? I mean, native LDL is harmless. So I think chelation does bring something to the table, and it's something that I think we need to resurrect.
Well, I'm glad you're open-minded as a cardiologist. The vast majority of cardiologists were stunned and surprised and still don't believe in chelation, even after a $31 million study performed by the National Institutes of Health. That's unfortunate. All right. Well, thank you very much for sharing with us your valuable time. And always we get great insights from you. The website is drsinatra.com. And so until the next time, you know, maybe we'll get you back, talk a little bit about EMFs later this fall. Let's mention again your upcoming webinar. That'll be on the 19th of September. Is that correct?
Yeah, 19th of September. They can go to drsinatra.com or heartmdinstitute.com, which is a purely informational website. There are pages and pages and videos of me. And basically, I'm doing a lot of myth-busting, Ron. So, you know, that's another great show we can do in the future if you want, dispelling the myths of medicine.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool. I'm having a lot of fun with that.
With pleasure. All right. Well, Stephen, thanks for getting the word out, and thanks for joining us today on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Until the next time, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.